Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 91 years ago today, on October 29th, 1929, the Wall Street stock market crashed, which spiraled the USA and most of the rest of the world into the Great Depression. The American president seemed clueless about what to do and personally surrendered to economic disaster. We remember him for the homeless Hoovervilles that sprang up all over the country, shanty towns built of debris and junkyards, or tent cities erected on the outskirts of various metropoli. And now, with this new millennium's first pandemic raging throughout the world, and the USA in particular, our blustering, egomaniac, dime store dictator has surrendered to the COVID plague after initially denying, then lying about its lethal magnitude. Are there to be Trump towns for the sick and dying multitudes? The premise that one political party be allowed absolute power in the claim that a single ideology is right and every other political option regarded as unpatriotic or treachery is the most pervasively dangerous aspect of contemporary politics in the USA. Ideology is powerful, especially when pandering to ignorance, fear, and hate. Coupled with avarice and racial and class discrimination, it is a recipe for the prejudicial disenfranchisement of ordinary Americans. The real trick or treat supersedes Halloween this year, with the official presidential election 4 days later. I have mixed a hodgepodge of former personal scribblings with a few right off the burner in response to this long, ongoing, unprecedented election. I call it reinventing democracy. Democracy begins at home, first in the heart. From there, it radiates through the house, into the neighborhood and community. We are a democracy, yet we know little about democracy. Personal sovereignty, independence, and equal rights do not come easily and never stay very long without constant feeding and nurturing. At this tumultuous, plague and rage-infested, nearly 11th hour on the electoral clock, it might be patently instructive to re-behold democracy. The USA is a democracy because it is a necessary contrast to despotic chaos and cruelty. We early 21st century Americans have inherited a few basic human rights and liberties sought by the mass of humanity for millennia. The oldest struggle after survival is for freedom, of being an equal part of a community, not enslaved by it. History shrieks with the pain of injustice, only briefly muffled by excesses of gross brutality. Sometimes the oppressed overthrow the lords and bosses, but elites always rise in even the most originally classless societies. The eternally relentless struggle against the old evils of worth and quality measured by wealth, gender, and race. It is the despairing rage of those who are unjustly condemned to live bitterly wretched lives in the shadows and as menials to the politically powerful few, who in their turn are angrily terrified by this rage. If the American Revolution 2.5 centuries ago is accepted as more than a revolt of colonial bourgeoisie, and that it gave birth to an entirely new fashion egalitarian society in which the common citizenry had a fresh chance to be their own rulers, sans gender and racial equivocations, it should also be realized that every reform, especially gender and racial issues, has been bitterly resisted and only adopted with great reluctance and no little pain. Our revolutionary ancestors who succeeded their Declaration of Independence with a national constitution knew very well that governments swallow the rights and freedoms of their citizenries, and that the natural inclination of authority is to concentrate and perpetuate its power. From the very beginning of the USA as a democracy, a powerful minority of wealth and property have insisted that political predominance belongs to the landed and corporate gentry, and the rest of the population are responsible for the nation's liabilities and obligations. The concept of original intent as the only legitimate interpretation of the Constitution is an absurd and dangerous notion contrary to the actual intent of the Constitution's authors to make it broad and flexible enough to reflect future ideas and problems they knew they were unable to anticipate or too contemporarily divided in opinion to resolve, among them, emancipation of slaves and women. The rigid concept of original intent is religious in its implication that all progress of intellect, thought, and purpose ended with the Constitution's origin. The Bill of Rights and subsequent constitutional amendments clarify that original intent was not as restricted as so-called Reconstructionists claim, but instead, as originally constituted, is an amendable document able to reflect and officiate a continually changing democratic civilization. And it has to be remembered that Americans have passionately squabbled among themselves as to exactly what sort of nation the USA is and ought to be. There should be no doubt. The people are the nation's governing sovereign. To protect democracy from predatory or cruel governance, the political freedoms and reigning sovereignty of the common citizenry is constitutionally the law of the land. Yet a government of the people is also for the people. Democratic populism is what Lincoln famously said it is, of the people, for the people, and by the people. The Bill of Rights were added to the main frame of the Constitution as its heart, and to give teeth to what the Declaration of Independence insisted were inalienable rights of ordinary people. The Bill of Rights are the Ten Commandments of American democracy. The First Amendment in particular is the connective tissue of the rest, with its clarion pronouncement that all Americans are free and equal in all basics of governance and law. These rights are from birth and lifelong. The essential purpose of democratic governance is to protect and enlarge those rights. That also means that majorities are not allowed to deny or subtract the rights of minorities, however unpopular and incompatible they might seem. Yet the USA has seldom been charitable to its minorities. Each and every outcast population struggle for equity that powerful intruders vehemently resist. Domestic politics in the USA are quickly becoming severe and confrontational. No mercy for the other, which is characterized by narrow and flogging perceptions of democracy that disrupts, undermines, and betrays democratic values. In this case, the laceration of deep-seated inferiority feelings of white Americans who react with fear and loathing against non-white minorities to ethnically cleanse abnormal, quote-unquote, Americans from society. True Americans are cajoled to eradicate fake or untrue Americans. The people's constitutional democracy has been under reckless assault by the highest elected official in the nation, who has for his entire four-year term been ripping apart democracy for his own perverted sense of personal absolutism. He is the gross epitome of racial and political divide and conquer opportunism. The USA has been, in effect, as a result of this swinish tyranny from the top, engaged in a third civil war. The first was to separate from its parent country's aristocratic imperialism and establish a democratic republic. The second was to bloodily define its right to exist by resisting secession and abolishing slavery, and afterward establish citizenship of former slaves. And the third is to preserve democracy from the nihilistic misanthropy of Orwellian deconstruction by a misfit president and rogue political party. The USA probably should, as so many suggest, refresh itself in this dark period of crises with a fresh infusion of original principles. But these are difficult to pin down and incredibly difficult to apply to an evolving and disrupted millennial society, besieged also by pandemic plague, as well as self-induced species extinction by an overheating planet, the result of human industry, and the always possible nuclear obliteration. The endless circle of individual rights and obligations melding within collective necessities is distinctly at play in this period of trauma and crisis. The USA is a democracy because it is necessary. It is not because of beneficent human nature that we have inherited a few basic rights and liberties sought by the mass of humanity for millennia. These democratic curbs on power are to limit the avaricious opportunities of taking away our political rights. Our freedoms are, in essence, our obligations as well, to preserve them for our descendants. Yet the further removed we are from the intense imperatives of our revolutionary ancestors for freedom and equality, the more we take for granted what they fought to establish, and the greater the danger we will allow them to be stripped away and abolished. Our ancestors had the courage to create this nation. It is up to its citizens to preserve it. The right to vote might just be our most precious right. Elections do have consequences. If we wish to take hope and some encouragement in the eternal struggle to retain liberty, equality, and justice, it would be wise to adhere to advice by James Boyle, who wrote, "One reason we have a democracy is because people make unspeakably stupid decisions without it." And that was something I wrote, Redefining Democracy. And now, by David Brooks. What will you do if Trump doesn't leave? Playing out the nightmare scenario. And he wrote this for the New York Times. On the evening of November 3rd, Americans settle nervously in front of their screens to await election results. In the early hours, Donald Trump seems to be having an excellent night, counting the votes cast at polling places. Trump is winning Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Those states don't even begin processing mail-in ballots until Election Day, yet Trump quickly declares victory. So do many other Republican candidates. The media complains that it's premature, but Trump world is ecstatic. Democrats know that as many as 40% of the ballots are mail-in and still being counted, and those votes are likely to be overwhelmingly for Joe Biden, but they can't control the emotions of that night. It's a gut punch. As the mail-in ballots are tallied, the Trump leads erode, but the situation is genuinely unclear. Trump is on the warpath, raging about fraud. Within weeks, there are lawsuits and challenges everywhere. It's like Florida in 2000, but the chaos is happening in many states at once. Ballots are getting tossed because of problems with signatures, or not getting tossed amid national frenzy. Trump says he won't let Democrats steal the election and declares himself reelected. It's an outrage. That is when he used the White House for a campaign prop during his convention. Who's going to stop him? A certain kind of Republican takes to the streets to enforce Trump's version of events. According to research done by Larry Bartels of Vanderbilt, 50% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents believe the traditional American way of life is disappearing so fast that we may have to use force to save it, quote unquote. Nearly as many believe a time will come when patriotic Americans have to take the law into their own hands, again a quote. The left is in the streets too. On the fringe of the left, there are those who want to overthrow the racist, cisgendered, patriarchal, neoliberal oligarchy. This is their chance at mayhem, too, and they seize it with sometimes violent passion. But a new force looms into view. For the whole Trump era, a certain sort of conservative has been cowering from the Trump onslaught. Certain sorts of moderates and liberals have also been keeping their heads down so they won't get bitten off by the woke mobs. But now the very existence of the republic is at stake. it turns out, amid the existential crisis, there really is a group of sober people who are militant about America, who can see reality unblinkered by the lens of partisanship, and who are finally compelled to organize. They understand that, like so many American tragedies, this is largely about race. It's about the transition from a certain kind of white-dominated America to a diverse America, and the people who will do anything to stop it. The Reverend Martin Luther King once argued that sin is buried so deep in the human soul that sweet words are insufficient to get people to give up their unjust power. Instead of assured progress in wisdom and decency, he wrote, man faces the ever-present possibility of a swift relapse, not merely to animalism, but into such calculated cruelty as no other animal can practice. And that was King. But the realist militants who walk in King's shadow also know that it is the U.S. Constitution that keeps us from slipping into chaos, along with all the norms and values built around it over the centuries. They know, too, that this crisis is not just about race, but also the greatness of American institutions, so scorned and derided of late, so neglected and abused. If Trump claims a victory that is not rightly his, a few marches in the streets will not be an adequate response. There may have to be a sustained campaign of civic action, as in Hong Kong and Belarus, to rally the majority that wants to preserve democracy, that isolates those who would undo it. Two themes would have to feature in such civic action. The first is ardent patriotism. The country survives such a crisis only if most people's love of nation overwhelms the partisan fury that will threaten to envelop us. The second is the preservation of constitutional order. Through epic acts of self-discipline, the nonviolent civil rights marchers in the 1960s forced their foes to reveal that if there were to be any violence and anarchy, it would come from the foes. That's how the movement captured the moral high ground and won the mind of the nation. The process of mobilizing for an accurate election outcome before it is too late would be a struggle to preserve the order of our civic structure against the myriad foes who talk blithely about tearing down systems, disorder, and disruption. It may be how we rediscover our nation again. It is time to start thinking about what you would do. And that was David Brooks writing for the New York Times. What will you do if Trump doesn't leave? And now, by Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. Confronting Racism. I'm a white anti-racist and retired college teacher, occasionally realizing that I'm complicit in a possible white supremacist. That's a real mouthful. But it has been my experience promoting anti-racist education that most white people don't really want to know what to do about racism, if it will require anything of them that is inconvenient or uncomfortable. It's difficult to mitigate or deflect feelings of racial discomfort. While it has been comfortable for me as a white person for 8 decades, challenging the racist status quo is not. Building the racial stamina required to challenge the racist status quo is a critical part of our work as white people. Reaching ahead to solutions, especially when we have barely begun to think critically about the problem, bypasses necessary personal work and reflection and distances us from understanding our own complicity. In fact, racial discomfort is inherent to any authentic examination of white supremacy. By avoiding the discomfort, the racist status quo is protected. Our demand for simple answers allows us to dismiss information. He didn't tell us what to do. That's especially arrogant when the demand is made of black, indigenous, and people of color. In essence, we're saying, you do all the work and take all the risk, then hand me the fruits of your labor. I will sit back and receive them while taking no personal risk myself. And what happens when we don't like those answers because they aren't quick, convenient, or comfortable? When the answers challenge our self-image as open-minded, progressive individuals, free of all racial conditioning. When we don't agree with the answers we have demanded, we all too often feel qualified to dismiss them. White supremacy is arguably the most complex social system of the last 100 years. But, of course, there are no easy answers for ending white supremacy. We need to challenge the apathy about white supremacy that I believe most white people feel. A list of why we don't know what to do might include the following. I wasn't educated about racism. I don't talk about racism with other white people. I don't talk about racism with people of color. I don't want to feel guilty. I haven't cared enough to find out. White people need to be willing to align what they profess to value, racial equality, with their actual practice, anti-racist action. There just aren't any simple answers. And that was by Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington, Confronting Racism. And now, something I wrote, Hair Trigger Birthdays. 58 years ago this past Tuesday, on October 27th, 1962, which was my mother Josephine Rosemarie's 50th birthday, her Sicilian maiden name was Campashani, old Mother Earth was almost murdered by a few of her children. That was the night of the Cuban Missile Crisis when everyone involved, American and Russian, thought they had lost control of their face-to-face diplomatic confrontation, and all that was left was pushing the doomsday buttons. That October Saturday night is considered the worst moment of the half-century Cold War between the USA and USSR. It is now claimed that our planet and species were not as close to annihilation as participants thought, and other brushes with nuclear obliteration occurred afterward, many probably publicly unknown. Others from well-publicized systems failures, in particular a few frightening instances of computer malfunctions averted breathtakingly close to points of no return when fleets of nuclear missiles would be sent aloft and continents nuked to ashes. The crisis started when the U.S. discovered Russian missiles being emplaced in Cuba, essentially because the USSR was apprehensive the USA was about to reinvade Cuba a year after its disastrous Bay of Pigs fiasco for another try to oust Fidel Castro's communist-inspired revolutionary government. The U.S. denied any further attempt to remove Castro, but had attempted several times to assassinate him, with exploding Cuban cigars, no less. The Cuban Missile Crisis has since been studied as an example for management of future nuclear contrarieties, although its lessons are probably as obsolete as the missiles of that period. The American myth is that the Soviet Union backed down from the brink of extinction and removed its missiles from Cuba. The claim that the Russians blinked at the brink overlooked what might actually have happened, that both American and Soviet leaders cut their 11th hour deal, the Russians to withdraw their missiles from Cuba in exchange for the U.S. to remove some obsolete missiles from Turkey, in fearful recognition that the military systems of both countries were moving inexorably toward nuclear confrontation. Although U-2 photographs disclosed the presence of the Russian missiles in Cuba on October 14th, President John Kennedy waited until October 22nd to publicly disclose their presence. My younger brother William, who had just enlisted in the U.S. Air Force, was 19 that day. So in my personal reckoning, the Cuban Missile Crisis started on my brother's birthday and ended 5 days later on my mother's birthday, when politicians overruled generals. The only blowouts were candles on two birthday cakes, fore and aft. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk engineered this program. It might be noted in closing that yesterday, October 28, 1886, the Statue of Liberty was formally dedicated. Emma Lazarus inscribed her famous poem on its pedestal. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. That is a direct refutation of Donald Trump's America with a K from an earlier, more humanely inspired vision of what the USA stands for. Stay safe. Lift your golden lamp to the sick and dying. And remember, protecting yourself protects everyone else. He walked into the park.